You are listening to the INCJ podcast, conversations about international criminal justice.
So welcome to Parkley Prison in Sydney. My name is Paul Baker. I'm the Governor of Parkley. I've been here since April 2019, when we first took over the contract. It's a private sector operation, part of the Corrective Services New South Wales network of 25 to 30 prisons across the whole of New South Wales. Currently looking after between 13,000 and 14,000 prisoners across the state. Parkley has an operating capacity of 1,350. I'll ask the people either side of me just to introduce themselves, and then we'll start by just talking about the issues that we faced, and I faced in particular in the early days of the contract, trying to establish a rehabilitative culture at Parkley. So I'll start with my Deputy Governor first.
Hello, I'm Sarah Mallander. I'm the Deputy Governor at Parkley, and I've been here since June 2020.
And my name is Ferry Lee. I'm a Senior Psychologist, as well as looking after the programs for Parkley Correctional Centre.
So Sarah, we'll start with you. Just talk a bit about your previous UK experience, first of all.
So I've got a range of experience in a number of different settings, both not-for-profit, private sector and public sector. And I've worked in and around corrections for a good number of years, at least 20-odd. For me, it's all about really what do we do to help inmates here specifically to move on in their lives, and to make a successful integration back into their communities, or indeed move seamlessly on to the next jail that they would go to after Parkley.
And can I just ask as well, what were the first things you noticed when you arrived at Parkley? So when did you come to Parkley?
I joined the Parkley team in June 2020. I think some of the first things were, interestingly, the palm trees, as well as the parrots and other flora and fauna in the site. And just a different way of doing things in the way of things such as more of a military style, I guess, of how to manage the prison. So certainly other things that are available to us here compared to the UK are things such as gas and also weapons in terms of control, I guess, around situations involving inmates. And a different culture. So what we're very, very big on here is reducing reoffending, and also we've got something called Bionic, which is Believe It or Not, I Care, which is embedded in the MTC philosophy over in the States, which we've adopted over here, which is around, for us, Believe It or Not, I Care, in safety, security and decency within the custodial setting. So this is something that's quite unique to Parkley. And I'm sure whilst the state prisons and other prisons have a similar take, this is something that we believe in. And we also have the Parkley Way, which is a number of factors which staff and also to a degree inmates sign up to as well, about having a sense of pride within the centre that we manage and doing the best for each other as colleagues, but also the best for our inmates as well. So that's something that we've worked hard to embed in the Parkley culture. Since I started here, I think as well what I find here is that the staff, and I felt this on day one, the staff have a real enormous pride in showcasing what they do and showcasing what we do as a centre. And every single visitor that I've brought in has actually commented on the enthusiasm, the pride and the passion that members of staff have when a visitor goes up and actually sees what we deliver on the ground. And equally, inmates have said to me themselves that it's a very different environment. They get treated as a human being, they get treated as a person, and that staff genuinely care. And I have a huge sense of pride when I hear that, both from visitors and inmates as well.
So there's a lot in what you said. Going right back to the beginning, you said there's sort of a semi-militaristic model. So what do you mean by that?
In the way of a parade at 8 a.m. every morning, which is a good opportunity actually for staff to get together. It's a roll call for staff and to make sure that we pass on important messages for each day. So if it's we've had to deal with a number of issues around COVID, so it could be around COVID, it could be a reminder of something, a visitor that's coming in, or a specific message that we want to get across. But the parade is exactly as you're saying, Paul, really, but it is an opportunity for staff to come together. But a parade isn't known in a UK centre. So that there's that really. I think that's the main difference that I noticed when I came here.
Yeah, I mean, I would reflect on the uniform of the state and the at all grades up to and including the governor. Everyone wears a uniform, and above that, at more senior levels of the service, and that struck me as being very, very different to what you would see in the UK. And a bit of me have always wondered about an approach in which you're trying to say that prisons are places where change is possible. They can be therapeutic environments in which we can bring out the best in people.
Yeah.
If the model is that there is a militaristic sense of dress, I wonder, I don't know the answer to this, I wonder if that would impact upon an inmate's perception of what it is that they're here for, and is it simply containment in a very restrictive way, or is it a place in which we hope to engage inmates to think about what their future might look like?
And one thing to highlight is that the corrective services uniform actually mimics that of the New South Wales Police. So it's a very similar colour scheme, ranking structure. So that's what inmates see when when people are out in the community, they see the police, but then when they come to the corrective services prison, they also see that same colour scheme.
Yeah, and so Kerry, you've worked, I think, in a state jail, and you've worked at this jail. Would you say there are some marked differences from what you found here to what you found working in your previous?
Yeah, I think the attitude. So culturally, what we try to project here at Parkley is very different to what I've seen in the state jails. The state jails have a very one-minded culture. I remember a quote that I heard. I don't remember where I heard it from, but someone said that correctional officers were the biggest gang in the state. So if you think about gang affiliations, a correctional officer says we're the biggest gang in the state. So when you have that mentality, it changes your interaction, your perception, and how you work with prisoners and inmates. Whereas here, I think that the biggest difference and the biggest difference in idea and how we treat people, number one, decency and respect is a really important thing, and something that really caught my attention before I started here was that Paul mentioned that when you work with inmates and work with people, if you treat them like a dog, they're going to act like a dog. So I think if you can change that perception and change the idea of how you work with people, because I think most people have a perception with people in custody that they will act in a particular way. But if you also treat them in that way, they'll continue to act that way. So you've got to think about how you treat them, using the philosophy of decency and respect. And also, as Sarah mentioned, with Bionic, Believe It or Not, I Care, when you follow through with something, or when you give an instruction, or when you provide an action, you have to have that sense of care about it as well. And that changes how you treat the inmate as well.
The other thing I think is broadly similar, and I welcome both of your views on this, is just the experience of the media. And the negative perception of inmates, prisoners, prisons, and the criticism that we may receive. And to most, I found that broadly similar to what we might have experienced in the UK. Generally, prisons are seen as places that people want to see people locked up. They want to see them punished. They want them to learn their lesson. They want them to not come back. So we need to be, tough and so on, which I don't have a particular issue with. But I wondered, probably Sarah, your experience or what you think about media coverage and portrayal of what it is that we're trying to do here, now that may act as a particular challenge at Parkley.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's very similar. However, I think there is the extra media spotlight on ourselves plus other private providers within the country. I think it would be probably similar to other jurisdictions in other countries as well. Because we're private, we do have that extra spotlight, that extra focus. So you might have a similar incident happen in a different prison that's state-run, And that wouldn't necessarily get any media attention or focus or anything else. So just this week, for example, a death in custody in another centre, a privately run centre, attracted media attention on a Facebook group as well. And whereas if that was to happen anywhere else, they wouldn't even probably get a mention. And I find that difficult, really, particularly for staff involved. So staff feel they have to go that extra mile to almost prove a point that we're just as good and we do the same role as other colleagues working in the state, whereas actually everyone's got an equally important role to play. Whether you're state, whether you're privately run, it actually doesn't matter. It's about what you actually do in the centre and then how you work as a network with colleagues in other centres to actually make the difference.
Yeah, I think the thing that struck me was the use of language, and certainly in the UK 20 years ago we debated the topic of, you know, what do we even refer to prisoners as? And there's been lots of debate, and I think sometimes it's a bit of a sideshow. But here in Australia they're referred to as inmates. In New South Wales that's fine. But the general language of talking about crims and crooks surprises me. And I'm not saying that's just within corrective services, but more generally in the wider community is something that has struck me. So I wonder if you've got a particular view about media portrayal, use of language, and actually is language that important?
Absolutely. I think it goes back to an us and them kind of mentality. So if you use us as the staff, the officers, the key holders, and then talk about the inmates or the prisoners as the crims and the crooks, it has that separation. And you get a bit lost in that. Again, if you don't have that approach of providing care, safety, decency, if you don't have that approach, then you can easily have that separation and say, well, I'm on this side of the line and you're on that side of the line. And I think that is probably a bit more glamorized in television, in the media, certainly on television shows about prisons and custodial settings. And again, it's probably more glamorized. I think what I want to say about that is that the layperson doesn't understand what it takes end to end from when a person comes into custody and then leaves custody. I don't think they understand what it takes to house them, manage them, to provide them with decency and security, safety. So when we talk about how much it costs to run a jail, the layperson will look at that number and go, that's too much. We should be spending that in other particular areas that they might want support in. But we know how important it is to be able to manage that person safely and securely. It costs a lot of money, but I don't think the layperson recognises that there's a huge investment. It's not just money, it's the manpower involved, it's the ability to run programs and education, it's the ability to have the inmates working so they feel like they're contributing to society. And then also that secondary thing, which is treating them in a particular way with decency, respect, so that hopefully they can carry that on when they do eventually leave as well.
Yeah, so there are some very some great similarities. I think you're right in what we see in the UK about the perception of crime, prisoners, what prisoners here to do. And the labour one is interesting. A good friend of mine, now dearly passed in the UK, Ruth Mann, used to say, why do we call offenders by the very thing we want them not to be? So if we refer to them as crims, refer to them as offenders, that's a label that potentially they will live up to, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so I'm pretty strong on that, I think. And certainly here we discourage use of any term like crims and crooks and so on. But equally, I won't go down the line of saying prisoners who are locked up are service users. I think there is a clear role for prisons to containly, securely and humanely contain prisoners in a secure environment. That is our number one priority for me, which is you must protect the public, is your first priority as a governor. And then to your point, Ferry, while you're here, you should be held safely and securely, and that there should be systems within your establishment that can enable you to facilitate an environment in which prisoners, when they leave, are just less likely to come back. Because the cost of reoffending is just eye-watering. And if you can start to reduce reoffending by 3, 4, 5, 6%, that's thousands of fewer victims every single year that that the community might experience, and that has to be our number one priority. I wonder, the other thing I have noticed, and I'll ask your views on this, is actually, are inmates ready for an environment in which we are trying to rehabilitate, and whether they see themselves actually as Crimson Crooks and this is the life they've chosen? And I wonder if either of you have got any reflection on that.
I think it depends on the inmate, and I think within every inmate's journey there becomes a point when they decide for themselves that actually now is the time to change. So we had a delegate committee, which is a committee consisting of inmate delegates from within the centre, because one thing that we're busy developing here is a refreshed strategy around how we keep Aboriginal inmates within the centre and in a safe and secure way. So we're looking at an Aboriginal inmate strategy here. And we had a delegate committee last week where one of the Aboriginal delegates had said he'd been in prison, he was former Stolen Generation, and spoke a little bit about his upbringing and his childhood, and then said he'd been in and out of prison for the last 20, 30 years. And he realised, being at Partley, actually, this is the time to change. And he was keen to pioneer and champion an initiative to support other inmates in and around the centre to also look at points of change in their life. And so I do believe that it might not be here at Partley right now, it might be in another centre further down the line in the sentence, or if they happen to come back to Partley, but there will be a trigger for everyone where they say, enough's enough, I've got to either get clean this time or stop doing what I'm doing or stop the repeated patterns of behaviour. It might not be for everyone, but I do think I've seen that in a majority of cases here. And I think when we have an inmate who puts their hand up to say, I want to stop and I would like some help to stop, then I think it's right that we put those strategies in place to help with that decision.
But Ferry, have you got a view about how inmates view themselves and whether they feel they're locked into this self-fulfilling prophecy in which this is their life and this is all they can expect, and whether it's a real challenge to get them to think they can do something different with their lives?
I think the words you use, self-fulfilling prophecy, are really important, because it's not just about the self-fulfilling prophecy of them living a life of crime, continuing to re-offend, but it's actually within the jail as well, within the correctional centre. They've got this perception that they need to be strong. And the idea of being strong in a correctional centre, in a prison, is to challenge when you're being challenged, is to puff your chest up, is to not ask for help, is to argue for what you want, to even get to the point of fighting to get what you want. So I think that's that sort of film prophecy. There's already that perception that that's how what strong looks like within jail. What we need to try and do is work towards what does strong also look like? Is it asking for help? Is it being able to educate yourself on how to education on anything really? Developing life skills. Getting an education in construction, first aid, whatever it might be. So we've got to change that definition of strong, because strong looks very different in a prison sense. And if we can change that, again, by reinforcing the idea of decency, safety, security, by engaging with them in a pro-social way. So, again, a lot of the staff, including the officers in particular, if they can engage with the inmates in a very appropriate pro-social way and set that example and model that behaviour, then that can go a long way to getting them to understand that they don't have to sit in that prototype of what jail strong looks like. It could be something completely different.
Yeah, I think they're good points. The other issue, and you mentioned it, Sarah, was First Nations people, Aboriginal inmates, and their experience in custody. I suppose the newest analogy to the UK is the black and minority ethnic population within prisons. And we know that at every stage of the criminal justice system in the UK, the BME population were overrepresented. So more likely to leave school early, more likely to be stopped and searched, more likely to be arrested, charged, sentenced for longer. And then while in custody, more likely to be disproportionately represented in terms of prison offences and so on. So I wondered if you've got any reflections on this particular issue, because I think you're right. I think if there's one thing I don't think we've done well enough and I want to do better, is how we support Aboriginal inmates while in custody and give them every opportunity to not reoffend when they come back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly that. And I think this is where the strategy that we're developing will really assist with that. And I think equally it's important that we get inmate buy-in to that strategy as well. So just us sitting around and thinking what might work for us as managers or colleagues within the prison might not work at all for the inmates. So I think the working party that we're setting up will be incredibly helpful for that. Because it's how inmates support other inmates from a peer perspective as well, which is, because obviously you can't have all of the inmates on a working party, but it's making sure that there's voice and there's representation from each of the residential areas to come together to look at what strategy would work. And the first discussions we had last week were around different programmes as well as other activities, so art, creative activities, various other things as well, even down to beads and items of cultural significance as well. And it was a really good, quite a passionate meeting really, with the inmates being expressing very clearly what they felt would work in a custodial setting, but also providing that peer support, which is incredibly useful. We have an excellent Aboriginal case planner here who the inmates respect. He's a paid employee, but there's only one of him. We've got to look at how we widen that support in order to provide the level of support, interaction and engagement that the inmates need here.
And Ferry, you're obviously an Australian and lived in Australia.
I don't look it, but I am.
And I never judge people by outward appearances. And the issue of the Aboriginal population, I take it, is a long-standing one. And I wondered what you thought of the particular challenges we might face in trying to engage that population.
I think, speaking for myself, it's a lack of understanding. So it's not to be ignorant, and it's not to not be interested, but it's just a lack of understanding. So finding opportunities to actually engage with someone who understands the culture, the Indigenous culture, and ask them questions. Sometimes you need to look a bit silly to be able to learn something, but my approach is always ask questions about what's the best way to engage with that particular culture, what are some of the cultural sensitivities that I need to be mindful of. And I think with this, the Aboriginal specialist that we do have on staff, he's going to go a long way, because we can ask those questions. We can ask about how do we provide the support that the Aboriginal cohort needs, and how do we do that in a respectful way. So I think, if anything, speaking for myself, it's more, it's not so much ignorance, it's just not knowing, but we have people that we can ask questions to, and we need to do more of that. And we also need staff to be mindful of their deficiencies in that area, because I don't think everyone will own up to saying they don't know enough about the Indigenous culture. I know I'm definitely one of them. I need to know more about it, so I'll go out and ask those people, because they're the experts in that area, and hopefully they can influence the rest of our staff in understanding that culture, so we can provide, again, programs and support and services to our Indigenous cohort.
I think you're right. I mean, I had a very, very steep learning curve when I first arrived around the issue of the Aboriginal population of inmates, and trying to get my head around and understand this wasn't the same as the BME issue in the UK. It's similar, but there are some real cultural differences that you've unpacked very well there. I think in relation to that, if I think back to the first few months here, and Sarah, you mentioned Bionic, so the MTC brand, all the jazz in the States and elsewhere, use Believe It or Not, I Care. And I remember certainly the challenging conversations I had about trying to use the word care in the context of corrections in New South Wales. It was incredibly difficult. It was very, very difficult to use the word care, just in the way in which we might securely contain and manage inmates. And I think the big thing that we did do well here was really try and say bionic doesn't mean care. It's not soft and cuddly. It's not fluffy. Care, I use in the sense of, believe it or not, I care about the thousands of victims that each of these men here may cause during a lifetime of criminality. I care about the fact that many of their families will serve a sentence alongside them. I care about the fact actually their children are much more likely to come back to prison. So the first thing was really saying that we need to really care about what we do. And then when we put bionic in the middle of a triangle in which we said we care about safety, we care about decency, and we care about security. And I think we were really able to drive that message. And I think the important thing from that message is, of course, those three things are fundamentally interlinked. And that is what has made this prison infinitely safer than it was in the first 6 months of takeover. So I wonder, probably Sarah, if you've got any reflections on how we tried to embed that concept and think about how security and decency and safety are linked.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's how those messages are played, I think, across the centre. So I know one thing, Paul, that you did was look at the Partly Way, because we needed to make sure, again, it goes a little bit back to programmes and developing initiatives for inmates. I think it's easy at an SMT level to sit and have a discussion about a strategy or a direction that you want the centre to go in. However, unless you've got buy-in from staff, it would be impossible to achieve. So looking at the Partly Way and also looking at the strategy that we have, where we've got different pillars around things such as safety, decency, security, which is each of those pillars is led by a member of SMT. And the thing is as well, they very much lean on each other. So you can't have a safe prison from a head of security perspective without them working with the head of residence to make sure that we've got a safe living environment. So you can have that interaction at SMT level, but it also needs to happen then at the other tiers within the centre so that everybody works together to create that one environment and that one approach to safety, decency and security within this setting.
And so for me, I suppose the challenge for staff is I'm trying to say if you act in a decent and respectful way to inmates, there are positive benefits in terms of your personal safety and also security. And for staff, that can be a bit of a challenge if they believe the safe way of managing inmates is containment and they're locked behind their door.
Yeah, but I think, you know, you said the word care, which is a really important word, and it's not about lovey-dovey, let's all hold hands and hug. It's really about, again, going back to that perception. So for me, we all work in corrections, we all work in correctional centres, and we probably all have really gruesome, horrific stories, things that we've heard about what inmates have done to other people. And I remember one particular situation, an officer referred to an inmate as a grub. And I said to him, well, why is a grub? What got him to that point that made him act in that way? And I think that's, again, if you change that perception, rather than saying he's a grub, he's not, he's a crib, being able to take a step back and go, well, what made him the person that he is now? What happened in his life, or what was missing from his life that allowed him to do that horrific thing? And I think that's, I don't know if it's a product of the work I'm in as a psychologist, but I think if you can approach our cohort and the people we work with a bit of empathy, we're going to then start to take a step back and go, okay, well, if this was missing, how do we then support that person? How do we put that back into their life so that when they do go out, when they're released in the community, because they will at some point, do they have the skills to be able to manage that and to you know, fill that deficiency and get the support that they might need?
So I suppose it's worth reflecting on, you know, Parkley is a prison, can take 1,350 inmates. We do have a small minimum security side where we have up to 130 inmates. In the main side, you know, we'll have over 1,100 maximum security inmates, but 80% of them are remand. And yet we know NTC is an organisation that really prides itself on changing lives through the delivery of a number of different programmes. And I think that's another big challenge here is the average length of stay here is often as low as 42 days, has been 35 days. And how do we deliver programmes in that context? Exceptionally difficult. And more importantly for me, though, is then what can we do on a daily basis to foster and support desistance? So I think my personal view is not enough is spoken about the concept of desistance, in which the vast majority of inmates, the vast majority of men and women in prison, will in effect grow out of, mature out of criminal activity and behaviour. And that is evidenced by the age curve, which shows a significant dropping off of offending and reoffending, certainly post 30. And for me, I've always been driven by thinking, how can I pull that point forward? Instead of someone getting to 32, 33, 35 and thinking, this has been a pointless experience being involved in criminal activity. How can I pull that forward so that we start to say, when they're 25 or 20, actually, I don't want a life like this? And I wonder, probably for you first, Ferry, have you got any thoughts about how we can do that? Because that's really been my mission and aim ever since I've been within a custodial environment. How do I offer a sense of hope and purpose to men and women who feel their life has no sense, has no hope, and has no purpose?
I think that's the billion-dollar question, isn't it? But maybe the starting point is finding out what motivates them. As a psychologist, motivation is a big thing. It gets you towards your end goal. So for a person that comes to jail and continues to reoffend, they're motivated by something. They end up in jail, but they're motivated by something, and that's what leads them to jail. So if we can find out what the motivation is to want them to be out, and for a lot of them it's family, it's, you know, having young children, it's, you know, parents, you know, disappointing them. It might even be, you know, having the motivation to run a successful business at some point. I can't remember the name of the person, but we've got a story of a person who spent time in jail but then got out and started working with the Indigenous community and found his calling there. So again, if we can find that motivation, hopefully we can start steering them towards things that they can do to keep on track with that particular motivation. But again, the motivation has got to be pro-social rather than, you know, getting a quick score or committing a crime to get something bigger. That motivation has got to be pro-social as well, so we've got to encourage that in some way.
And Sarah, your background is in the head of reducing reoffending, and I wonder what your view is, what the balance is between offering programs and supported assistance. Is it a 50-50 split? Is it predominantly around how you offer hope and sense of purpose, or is it that you can simply target people with a program if they fit into a certain category that will produce the outcome that you expect and want?
Yeah, I think it would be around about a 50-50 split. And I think it's also, and Ferry touched on it earlier, about pro-social modelling from staff in between times, and also making sure that we think that everyone here is capable of change. And it might not be change right now, it might be change further down the line, but I'm a big believer in that people can change. And if people don't want to change, then of course, then you end up with the cycle, and then you look at the inmates coming back in. I've been here now almost 2 years, and you do see the same faces come back in, and sometimes they're actually quite pleased to see you, which always gives me cause for concern. Why are you happy to be back? And they say, well, I get treated with respect here, and I also get routine. So they know that a meal is at a certain time, that this happens at a certain time, and this happens at a certain time, which, if you've got a chaotic lifestyle in the community, to come back here and have that sense of routine and talking to some of the inmates about what they actually found helpful around a custodial setting is a place to detox, a place to get clean, whereas they know they haven't got a hope in the community of doing that. So they come here and set themselves a goal of then getting clean. But I think really looking at preventative measures as well, it's what do you do prior to someone coming into prison to then stop them? So community interventions is also something I think that's incredibly helpful, and any peer support that you can provide, because they might not listen to us. As an inmate said to me last week, I'll go back to my $1 million house and I'll be all right for the night. So why would they listen to me when I haven't got the lived experience, but they will listen to others? So it's as much support that you can provide in that pro-social sense to look at people's and whether or not you can influence the change in that way.
It's interesting because actually as you're speaking, you sound more as if you're in support of a model that supports assistance.
Yeah.
So I'm not really a big fan of a very formulaic approach to trying to reduce reoffending. That the sole focus should be on targeting people who are at high risk of reoffending. We know that evidence says the risk-need-responsivity principle will say they are more likely to be positively affected by the programme, which I get, and I wouldn't argue with that at all. I think that's entirely right. But for me, the most important thing is the context.
Yeah.
That programme is delivered. And so in the UK, there was an audit that took place, not just of your ability to deliver your programmes, but they audited the staff's view of programmes, because there will be nothing more dispiriting or negative for an inmate if you go to do a programme, you feel you're doing really well, you're getting positive feedback, and an officer just says, yeah, you'll keep coming back, you're just a crim. And that, I think, is sort of the key to unlock much of this. Recruiting many staff who believe, and I think you said very, change is possible, because change is. And 99% of all of these fellas in, you know, will stop offending at some point. So it comes back to, how do you engage them earlier to say, you need to do that program? And then you get them on the program.
And I wonder, you know, we're, as psychologists, we're guided by this whole risk need responsivity within correctional services and within reducing reoffending. But maybe that fourth overarching thing is the environment, rather than just looking at those three things and thinking that's going to be the golden arrow. It's looking at the environment, making sure the environment is set up so that you can do those things.
I think that's exactly right. So I'm going to think now then about, you know, we've been here 3 years. It has been an exceptionally challenging 3 years, I have to say. Not least of which, and I may get Sarah to talk a bit about management of COVID since we've been here, that has stifled our ability to roll out some of the innovations that we hope to deliver in our bid. But if I think about some of the areas where I've taken greatest pride in doing something fundamentally different, I think the first thing I'd probably highlight is the drug recovery wing, that we created an environment in which inmates on remand can live as a community, receive offending behaviour programmes, be given lots of activity to keep them engaged, and spend 3 months going through a process which, for the first time for many, they're living in an environment which encourages them to be drug-free. And it was very difficult at first. And it was difficult because the staff saw a negative mandatory drug test or a targeted test as failure. Whereas we know with recovery from addiction is a journey. And fortunately for us, we have used Gethin Jones from the UK to be able to support both the staff and the prisoners as they go through this journey. And Gethin will say, you know, he had 14 detoxes. So that makes people think, actually, this is a journey. And we're putting people on the first footing of, this is a journey for you, and we're going to help you try and achieve a drug-free lifestyle.
But if I can jump in really quickly on that, like, if we're working with a cohort that uses drugs, what do you expect? They're going to get negative urinalysis. So, again, it's changing that perception. What I said earlier, if the officer already has that perception that, oh, you're a drug user, we've caught you, now you're going to be punished, that's different to the perception of, oh, you made a mistake, how do we get you back on track?
I think it's exactly right. And that is a very big challenge, and that's a very big challenge here. But it was in the UK when we rolled out the use of methadone and so on in the UK. It was much the same. That staff really struggled. It was IDTS at the time, Integrated Drug Treatment Program. They really struggled with that. So Sarah, thinking about your experience over the last couple of years, what do you think are some of the initiatives that we have been successful in trying to embed publicly?
I think there's two standout initiatives for me. One would be the red dot policy. So we have a policy in Partly that if an inmate has got a history of or displays aggressive tendencies within the centre towards a member of staff or in any setting, what we would do is we would recommend them to go on to the red dot scheme, which sees the red dot placed against their name. Obviously, the inmates don't know that they're on the red dot scheme, but it's a way of staff being aware that an inmate has displayed violent tendencies. So to just take extra care and to make sure that they've got sufficient staff and colleagues with them when they deal and liaise with this inmate. The other programme would be the blue dot scheme as well, which we introduced as part of our safer custody strategy. So again, if you've got an inmate who's being transferred in from a different centre with sufficient evidence that he's attempted suicide or self-harm in a previous custodial setting, or indeed states that they are contemplating self-harm here in Partly, we will place them on the Blue Dot programme, which is really just a way of custodial staff within the residential areas just taking an extra just a little bit extra care and also doing an extra case note just to make sure that the inmate is doing okay with the time in custody. And then for any further interventions, Ferry and his team will work with those particular inmates, and then we could also call upon St Vincent's, our health provider, for psychiatric support if required. So that scheme in itself has actually seen levels of self-harm reduce at Partly by 40% over 12 months. So I think there's still things that we can do and we should be doing as part of our safer custody strategy to review the programme. Obviously, we've also got to consider Aboriginal deaths in custody, which is a risk factor to us. It's a risk factor to custodial settings across the state. So again, this would be something that we can look at as part of our Aboriginal strategy going forwards. And some of the inmates at the committee last week had got some ideas about how that could work as well in practice. So I think those would be two standout things really that we've done and run successfully here.
Okay.
I'll echo the things that Sarah mentioned, but I think one thing that's yet to be implemented is the Gold, Silver, Bronze scheme. And I'm really looking forward to that because before I started in November of 2021 and I was told about the scheme and I think it allows inmates to have an idea of where they are in the system, but also gives them an incentive to not only continue to progress, but there is a possibility that they could regress within the scheme, which again takes away some of their incentives. I think I'm really looking forward to having that in place at some point.
Yeah, so the Gold, Silver, Bronze scheme, people in the UK will know it as the IEP scheme, Incentives and Then Privileges, and it came in after the Manchester riots in the 90s and other riots. And it was really a way in which it was saying that we know that the most effective way of managing and changing people's behaviour is actually to reward people, not just punish them. If punishment worked, all the prisons would be closed. So clearly that doesn't work by itself. I was very surprised to arrive here, and when I looked at the number of charges that could be laid against an inmate for breaches of prison discipline, it was over 60. The UK, I think it was 25 by the time I'd left. So it seemed to be very much an approach of, if you do this wrong, this will be the consequence. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's fine to have a consequence for negative behaviour. But there was little reward, it felt, for positive behaviour. And so if you behave, then what? And why I think this is of fundamental importance is it feeds into the desistance theory of how and why people change. And one of these is that you develop a sense of personal agency. You feel you have some control over your destiny. So if you have an environment in which, no matter what you do, every time you do something wrong, you're going to lose something, you quickly find a prison, in my view, where you have nothing to lose. And that's incredibly dangerous. So we rebranded here the Incentives and Privileges Scheme, the Gold, Silver, Bronze Scheme. And for a period, we were able to run it relatively successfully. And we have a gold pod, and inmates in there have a number of privileges that other inmates don't have. For example, they have vending machines that they can access and so on. And what that started to do was to say to prisoners, if you do something wrong, you may end up on bronze, which we would in the UK have called it basic, but there are lots of positive things for you to aspire to. And this is now up to you. You can be positive and you can engage and you can go to the gold pod. So instead of me saying, if you do this, then that, and I'm going to control your destiny, it's now up to prisoners to say, actually, I'm in control of my destiny, which is, again, one of the things we know that supports desistance. So you're right, gold, silver, bronze, when we tried to manage through COVID, was very difficult to manage. And to be honest, it was impossible. But now we're in an environment where that's starting to pick up again. And you can hear inmates talking about wanting to be a gold level inmate. And one of the big advantages of gold level inmates, and the first thing I learned in Australia, is that people will do anything for a barbecue. So if we promise them a barbecue once a month, the staff, prisoners, it's just a very big thing where it's understanding what really makes people tick. And that's a very simple thing. Suddenly they're going, oh, so I can have a barbecue. And having a barbecue actually makes you feel normal for an hour while you're just out there with your mates having a burger. So this is some powerful stuff that we hope to unpack and restart. I'm conscious of time now, so I'm going to start thinking again about the future and initiatives that we would hope to see rolled out. And really, some of these are in response to the challenges that we face. So, Sarah, I wonder if you could talk a bit about the Buddy Scheme And that this is a staff initiative, and what we hope to do by rolling out that scheme.
So one thing that we're in the process of rolling out for this current, we've currently got a cohort of trainees in the final couple of weeks now of training. So I think that you can provide new trainees with a whole range of policy. You can sit them down for a period of time over in the classroom, but actually nothing beats getting onto the floor for the first time and having that experience of working as a custodial officer. I think when you feel that the eyes of the inmates are upon you, and watching every move, and they might not be, but I think that's how you perceive it to be. So one thing that we've introduced for this current group of trainees is a buddy, where the new officer has been matched up with a more experienced officer who will provide that level of coaching and mentoring for them when they start in their first few weeks of a new job, which is incredibly tough and a scary time. And I think nothing really prepares you for that first time when you're walking in, having graduated from your course. So we feel that will be a useful programme to help instil confidence in some of the new staff that we have.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth reflecting on the fact that, you know, not only do we have prisoners here for an incredibly short period of time, 35, 42 days, but that actually around 50% of all of the officers here have 2 years' experience or less. And so I'll talk a bit about what we're doing now around Jailcraft, but Barry, I wondered if you could talk about the listener scheme, because the listener scheme is well established in the UK and it's something we tried to get off the ground here now. So just the next steps for the listener scheme and what it is.
Yeah, I think from the psychology team perspective, the more staff, the more we can get to the areas, to the inmates, to provide the support they need. But we're not made of money and we can't have an unlimited amount of resources in psychology. So the next best thing is probably to get the peer listener scheme program happening. And that's about providing some training around how to interact. It's inmate focused. So we recruit inmates to be peer listeners. And what they do is they act as the eyes and ears of the whole jail, but also for the psychology team, to find out whether people are coping within the jail environment. And part of the listener scheme is to give them some training, so get them to understand the mentality involved within the jail setting, some of the positive things that happen, but also some of the negative things, and how we can actually manage that risk a little bit. So I think that's really exciting, because that's a very inmate-driven initiative, and it allows them to not only feel a sense of purpose, to provide something to their peers and the community, but it also gives them some training in being able to deal with this as well. And that's, we need all hands on deck in this particular situation. So while we've got staff, officers that are able to support inmates, if we have inmates supporting inmates, there's more power involved in that. So that's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I do look forward to it. And I think it's essential here in a remand prison, very high risk of self-harm, suicide, etc. So I look forward to that. I think I would highlight what we intend to do over the next few months around delivering Jailcraft training and alongside that 5-minute intervention training. So the staff, by their very nature, with the turnover that we've had, are relatively inexperienced. The term we use in the UK was always Jailcraft, which was, do you really understand what it means to be a good correctional officer? Can you put yourself in the inmate's shoes and think, actually, why is it so important that we get this thing fixed and that we do this thing? So it's really trying to teach them what I would see as the golden rules of being a good corrections officer, one of which, for example, is if you say you're going to do something, you must do it. Don't fob off inmates and so on, because that builds a sense of trust. And if you have a sense of trust from inmates that you do what you say, it just makes the jail a whole lot safer, because they will tell you things. That's what makes prisons safer, when you have that positive type of relationship. And the other thing, Ferry, you'll know this, is I'm now also looking at how we roll out a variation of what was called the 5-minute intervention in the UK, which really is good old-fashioned Jailcraft. And it's saying in 5 minutes, when you're having a conversation with a prisoner, you can ask some open-ended questions that starts to guide them to their own solutions. So again, instead of spoon-feeding a prisoner, you need to do this, you need to do this, you need to do this, asking questions like, what do you think you might need to do to resolve this? And helping guide them, again, develops a sense of personal agency, and actually I'm in control of my destiny, aren't I? And with the support of staff, I can actually get to a place where, when I get out, I'm just much less likely to reoffend. And that, to me, is the magic bullet, where I would like the whole prison to get that sort of rhythm, and this is how we engage with prisoners. Because in a remand prison, we cannot fundamentally reduce reoffending by delivering lots and lots of programmes. The prisoners simply aren't here, and we can't do offence-specific work. So I think that's the next the next few months has to be focusing in on that, developing the relationships with prisoners through listeners, develop relationships with our staff, giving them the skills and helping them feel supported. Because for me, it's staff first. If you get the staffing right and you get the right staff doing the right thing in the right way at the right time, you will have a successful prison. And that's the big challenge for us at the moment. Okay, I'm just going to ask for any closing thoughts then from either you, Sarah, or Ferry, really on where you think we are in our journey and what you think the most important next steps are for us to take, I think, to really try and solidify the progress that we have made. So
obviously we were successful, MTC Broad Spectrum was successful at the bid where we took over from a different company. So I think really we're still, it feels in some way we're still as part of the transformation journey. So those of us who've been involved in bidding before, we know the phrases mobilisation, transition, transformation. So we are at the transformation point, I think, and I don't think that's necessarily a fast journey, nor should it be. I think particularly when you've also got staff who've worked for the previous provider, it's for them to also look at a new way of working, and it's a journey that you have to go on together. So I think it's about us solidifying the really good work that we've done over the past couple of years and then developing a plan for everything that we want to do. So having a look at the plan for the next few years. So, Paul, you mentioned earlier the fact that we also have a minimum security centre as well, which sits separately from the main centre. It's what are we doing for those inmates who are very different groups. So that's something that we're looking at. For how we can, we want to really be the leading light in minimum security management around programs, around interventions, around making sure that the inmates move successfully back out into the community and get a job. You know, for some of them, they actually don't feel they're capable of getting a job because of their offending background. So it's how do we challenge that? So I think it's about having clear plans to go forward for each area of the centre, and work together as an SMT and then work together at different levels across the centre then to deliver those plans.
Okay.
I think what we've spoken about bionic, believe it or not, like care. And I think what I've seen from some staff is that they kind of treat it a little bit like a joke. They mention it jokingly and in passing, but the funny thing is they actually display it. So even though they talk about it and maybe like to have a little bit of joke around the whole I'm bionic kind of thing, they actually still do live that and still display that with the group they work with. So I think that's really positive. My experience in the state-run jail was very different. Not everyone and a very small percentage of the group that I worked with had that idea of care and providing safety, security, decency. So I think I've seen a lot more of that within our centre, which is really positive. And it's those people that we can then use to influence the others to come along. So I think in my experience, when you're working with people, and especially with behaviour change, you've got that small percentage that don't want to change and they're really difficult to work with. You've got that other side, the percentage that are really bought in and really want to make that change. And you've got that group in the middle that's kind of on the fence. And what we need to maybe focus on is that group that we have that are bought in and really want to change, and see how they can influence those people in the middle. Not to say that people at the other end of the spectrum are a waste of time. I think we can still try to improve that relationship and get them on board. But we've got a huge cohort of people that are ready to buy into the idea of bionic. And even though people use it jokingly, there's a lot of people here that display it, which is really positive.
Yeah, I would echo that. I mean, first thing I did when I became governor was move my office right in the middle of the prison. And previously it was outside. And when I said I'm going to move inside the staff, so that's a really good idea. Although they quickly realised that isn't always a good idea, because I'm very visible and I see what goes on. But I think the most heartening thing for me that I started to see within a few months was staff being willing to engage in the right way with prisoners, talk to them, listen to them, treat them as people, because they are. And then what we saw over a period of time, certainly in that first year of operation, was that the jail became safer. And I think that again becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It reinforces what we've been saying. Because quite frankly, if a prisoner trusts you, respects you, if things go wrong, they are just less likely to hit you. And that's a fundamental principle, is one of the first things that we said. I'd say the challenge has been really, in the last 18 months, has been managing this through COVID. And that COVID, with many restrictions, many lockdowns, has meant that I would say we're probably 80% towards having the sort of prison that I think this can be. So we're a long way there. We've done some very good stuff. And there are some other things now that we need to embed in the next 12 months. You know, and that's our challenge. But I would say, you know, I have a senior management team around me that I have absolute confidence in, and know that this jail will be one that well, I'm already proud of, and that everyone who works here should be proud of. So I'll end there, just saying thank you to both. I'll check the camera now, make sure it was recording. Otherwise, I'll have to do it all again. Thanks all.
You have been listening to the INCJ podcast, conversations about international criminal justice. To find out more, go to our website at criminaljusticenetwork.net or follow us on Twitter at INTCJ Network.